You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And we've got a lives theme to our show today, your own life and others' lives, how to use them, really. Our studio guest is Jeremy Dronfield, talking about The Boy Who Followed His Father into Auschwitz. We'll also hear from Claire Mully. She's written a biography of Eglantine Jebb, who founded the charity Save the Children, and jeweller Harriet Kelsall. She talks about how she used her own experiences to write The Creative's Guide to Starting a Business. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark, Jeremy.
Well, thank you.
We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. We're going to be talking today about your book, The Boy Who Followed His Father into Auschwitz. But you're, as well as writing that book, you're also, and being an author in your own right, you're also a ghostwriter, aren't you?
Yes, I've covered quite a lot of bases in my career. I started out in the academic world, then I became a novelist, and finally worked my way into ghostwriting and writing narrative non-fiction, as well as authoring my own non-fiction books. I also work in publishing consultancy, helping other people get their books published, and read for a literary agency. And it was through doing that work that I came across this story, The Boy Who Followed His Father into Auschwitz. And I was, the story of Gustav and Fritz Kleiman in the concentration camps is based mainly on a concentration camp diary kept by Gustav Kleiman throughout over 5 years in the camps, from Buchenwald, Auschwitz and other camps. And I was approached, I was asked by a friend of the family to help find a publisher for an English translation of the diary. Now, the problem with that was that Gustav's diary, or however important it is as a historical document, and although it's an incredible story, his son's time in the camps, the diary is extremely difficult to read. It's quite sketchily written, there are a lot of gaps in it, and it's full of very obscure references to people and places and incidents. Even a specialist Holocaust historian wouldn't be able to understand a lot of it without consulting their reference books. So I decided that this was a story that really needed to be brought to the public because of this central incident, which is reflected in the title of the book, that Fritz Kleiman volunteered to go to Auschwitz with his father, even though he knew it was a certain death sentence. So I decided the best way I could serve this story was to bring my abilities as a researcher and a writer to it and develop it, do additional research, seek out extra sources, and write it as a completely accessible narrative piece of nonfiction. And that's what I did.
So you were able to use all those skills at once.
Yes, absolutely. It took a huge amount of research. At first, I thought I might have to fall back on my background as a novelist because it looked like I might only have a diary and a short memoir that Fritz had left behind. And there didn't seem to be enough material there to write it as purely non-fiction. So I considered writing a truth-based novel. But then the more I dug in to the research, the more material I found, the more new facts, the more it became fleshed out. And I realized eventually that I had more than enough material to do an entirely non-fiction story of Gustav and Fritz Kleiman and write it in a way that it should read like a novel, even though there's not a single thing in there that's invented.
It's an extraordinary book. I'm looking forward to talking to you about it. But we'll listen to your first choice of music now. Is music important to you, Jeremy?
Oh, absolutely, yes. It's possibly more important to me than writing, I think. Uh, it's,
So these tracks are very important to you there. First one is Terra Nova by I Like Trains. Why this one?
Well, I'm very drawn to narrative music, whether it's songs or just pure music. And this track is actually based on... The lyrics are taken from the diary of Scott of the Antarctic. And it's about that expedition. And it struck me as... It struck a chord in relation to the story of Gustav and Fritz Kleinmann in the concentration camps. The thing that recurs again and again in Gustav's diary is his refusal to submit. He was absolutely determined to survive and really believed that he would, even really near the end when everybody around him was dying. And there's a piece he wrote in his diary in the last few weeks when 50 to 60 people per day were dying around him. And he referred to it as the perfect bone mill. And he said, "One can scarcely drag oneself along, but I have made a pact with myself that I will survive to the end. Every day I say a prayer to myself, Gustav, do not despair, grit your teeth, the SS murderers must not beat you." But there's a line in Robert Scott's diary, which occurs in the song. He writes, "Great God, this is an awful place. I do not think that we can hope for any better things now." And the contrast between Gustav's belief that he would survive against all the odds and Scott's acceptance that he was going to die, is that really struck me as a powerful contrast between those personalities.
That's Terra Nova by I Like Trains, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our studio guest, Jeremy Dronfield. Jeremy's first novel, The Locust Farm, was shortlisted for the John Creasy Award for debut crime fiction. His non-fiction work includes Dr. James Barry, A Woman Ahead of Her Time, published in 2017, which was a Sunday Times Book of the Year, and The Guardian described it as scintillating. Earlier this year saw the publication of The Boy Who Followed His Father into Auschwitz, the extraordinary true story of Gustav and Fritz Kleinmann, who not only endured the Holocaust and survived, but managed to stay together throughout their ordeal. It's a Sunday Times and Amazon bestseller. The I said of it, it's an emotionally devastating story of courage and survival. I agree with that quote, Jeremy. There is lots of horror in it and lots of dark things, but there is, through all of this, survival and love.
Yes, they were in an incredibly close family, the Kleinmanns. I mean, I had got to know the story through Gustav's diary, through this short memoir by Fritz, but during the course of my research, I managed to track down the last surviving member of that generation of the Kleinmann family, Kurt Kleinmann, who managed to escape from Nazi-occupied Vienna in 1941 when he was an 11-year-old boy and went with a transport of a small number of children to America.
So he was Fritz's brother?
He was Fritz's Gustav's younger son. Brother. And he and Fritz were best friends as boys in Vienna. And Kurt was an enormously valuable source of knowledge about what the family were like, what their life was like in Vienna before Hitler came, as Kurt puts it. And they were a really, really remarkably close, warm, loving family. And once you understand that, you begin to get an insight into the motivation that kept Fritz and Gustav together, because they weren't the only father and son in the camps. They weren't even the only father and son on the transport that took them to Buchenwald in 1939. There were 1,035 Jewish men on that transport in October 1939. By the end of the war, only 25 of those men were still alive. And as I said, there were other fathers and sons. None of those survived. But they managed to stay together. And they survived. Fritz was only a teenage boy when he was sent with his father. And they miraculously managed to survive 3 years in Buchenwald while the men around them were being murdered, starved, dying of disease, dying from accidents, and you being used as slave labour. Then in 1942, Gustav was one of 400 Jewish prisoners who were slated for transfer to Auschwitz. Even in those circumstances, they knew what Auschwitz was. They knew its reputation, and they understood that that was a virtually certain death sentence. But as soon as Fritz heard about this, he volunteered to go with his father on the transport. He had friends who tried to persuade him not to. They told him, if you want to go on living, you have to forget your father. But that was just impossible for Fritz, and he went to the SS and he volunteered and he was added to the list. And those 400 men went to Auschwitz, and extraordinarily they survived the selection when they arrived. Especially extraordinary in Gustav's case, because he was over 50 by this point. And even more miraculously, they went on to survive another 2 years, more than 2 years, in Auschwitz. By the end of that period, within a few months, in fact, of their arrival in Auschwitz, only 100 of that 400 transport from Buchenwald was still alive. And they survived torture, abuse, starvation. Fritz became active in the camp resistance. At one point, he even smuggled weapons into the camp with the aim of resisting the Nazis in a last stand. And they survived, ultimately.
Why did they survive, do you think? What was it about them? As you say, people were dying right, left and centre around them. What was it that they had that kept them going?
There are a number of factors. There was Gustav's character, which I've already talked about, is this sheer optimism, this determination, this belief that he was going to survive. That helped. Their devotion to each other. They helped each other to survive practically and in terms of morale. They gave each other the courage and the to some extent the motivation to go on. They also survived with the help of friends. When they arrived in Buchenwald, there was a generation of prisoners who had been in the camps for years. They were all political prisoners from the early days of the Nazi regime, and they had formed a support network, and Gustav, that helped newer prisoners like Gustav and Fritz to survive, and the same in Auschwitz. But most of all, probably the most consistent thing would be just sheer luck. In 1943, when Fritz had become involved in the resistance at Auschwitz and was involved in helping to facilitate escapes from the camp, he was suspected by the camp Gestapo and was taken and was tortured by SS Lieutenant Maximilian Grabner, who was head of the Auschwitz Gestapo. He was beaten, he was hung by his wrists. This happened over the course of several hours, and it would have carried on until he was dead. But it happened to be a Saturday night, and Grabner was keen to get home for the weekend. So he had Fritz sent back to the camp, and with the understanding that the torture would resume again on the Monday morning. And his friends in the resistance helped swap Fritz's identity with a prisoner who had died from disease, and he managed to escape the rest of the torture. And then there were instances like that where one or other of Gustav or Fritz managed to survive just through lucky chance. Things like being ill in the camp infirmary and just happening to get better just in time before there was a selection for the gas chambers. And this happened again and again.
How did it feel writing about this? Very emotional reading it. But and you say at one point, I brought the story to life with all my heart. Clearly you felt an emotional connection. I just wonder how it felt reading and writing about all these terrible things, but also about the love that is at the core of it.
Yeah, it's a really powerful emotional story to write, to get to grips with. It's slightly less intense when you're writing it than if you're reading it, because for me it was spread over the course of 3 years, getting to know the story, getting to understand it, and you tend to get quite wrapped up in all the technical aspects of it, having to pull together all these different quite complex stories to fit together to make this very well, this story that I wanted to be as factual as it could possibly be. So I had to get absolutely everything right. So you don't get the emotional carnage in one big rush the way you do when you read a book. And this was spread over 3 years. But even so, it was really quite harrowing to write. You can't make it a really engaging emotional story unless you're connected closely to it on that emotional level. And for me, the hardest part was writing about the family members who didn't survive. Gustav's wife, Tini, and their second daughter, Herta. They didn't survive the Holocaust. They were taken in 1942 and were murdered at the death camp at Malitrostenets near Minsk. And I still find that quite hard to talk about, especially in relation to Kurt, because they were so loved by Kurt, and because it's always difficult when you've finished writing somebody's family story to show them what you've written, because you don't know how they'll feel about what you've done with their story. With Kurt Kleinman, it was much more intense than that, because I knew that when he read that book, he would be learning for the first time some of the details of what happened to his father and Fritz in the camps. And although he obviously knew that his mother and sister had been murdered at Malitrostenets, he knew nothing about the details of how it happened. That camp is really very obscure because hardly anyone survived it. And no one survived from the transport that Tini and Herta Kleinman went on. So I had to pull together from various very obscure sources how that camp was run, how the murders were carried out. And he told me afterwards that reading it, it was devastating. But at the same time, he was glad that he knew it at last. Kurt has this need to know everything about what happened, not just to his family, but to everyone in the Holocaust, however painful it is.
Thank you, Jeremy. We'll come back and talk to you some more about the book. But we'll hear now from Claire Mully. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the founding of Save the Children. To mark that centenary, Claire Mully's first book, The Woman Who Saved the Children, a biography of the charity's founder, Eglantine Jebb, is being reissued. When it was first published in 2009, it won the Daily Mail Biographers Club Prize, and Gordon Brown described it as truly brilliant. When I met Claire to talk about the book, I asked her if it was true that Eglantine, despite her life and legacy, didn't really like children.
Not individually very much, no. She once famously called them the little wretches. And even in the year that she founded Save the Children, 1919, she wrote to a friend that, "I suppose it's a judgment on me that I'm made to talk all day long about the universal love of humanity towards them. Yuck." So, yeah, it does raise quite an interesting question. Why save the children then? There are lots of reasons for this. I mean, Eglantine had commissioned some early research into child development and what happens after a period of famine or starvation. And she knew that whereas adults can make up the lost ground, a child may be permanently set back both psychologically and physiologically. And also she subscribed to this idea that children, well, it's not just an idea, it's the truth, children are the future and we need to invest in our future citizens. And 1919 is right at the end of the First World War. There was this strong feeling that we need to invest in peaceful future relationships internationally. Also, she knew that children made a very good marketing hook, if you like. She was very innovative in her fundraising. One of the things she did is she brought celebrities on side for the first time. You can't imagine it without them now. She brought on side George Bernard Shaw, the playwright, who gave her a line she used a lot, which is, "You know, I don't know about you, but I have no enemies under the age of seven." But all of these are just sort of other reasons. I think essentially everyone expects her to be maternal, and she wasn't. She wasn't a very maternal woman. She wasn't sentimental about children. And actually, perhaps this was an advantage for her in her role. She was very clear-sighted about it. And she saw children not to be patronised as cute little animals or essentially evil when they were born, which was kind of a fairly standard view at the time. She saw them as people, as human beings, and she respected them. And this enabled her to do something very significantly important, which is to invest in them as young people, to have lives that are important as a child, that are also important as future adults, and that they should also be party to human rights, because she not only found to save the children, she also developed the concept of children's human rights and pioneered the first statement of rights that's now the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, the most universally accepted human rights instrument in history.
And when did you first hear about her?
I used to work at Save the Children for quite a few years, actually. I first saw a photograph of her above my boss's desk, and she looked a bit like my boss, slightly terrifying. I didn't really like my boss that much at the time, but now we're good friends, so I shouldn't say that. I thought, well, if that's what Egan Thomas is like, maybe I'm not to find out any more about her. But then I came across this sketch she did. She had a great sense of humour. I loved her. She was constantly drawing these little rather naughty sketches of bishops and things and leaving them on church floors if she was angry. She drew a picture of herself striding into action with this big file of important papers under her arm. But if you look a bit closer, you see that the papers are all falling out the back. Her shoelaces are undone and trailing in the mud. And I just thought, OK, why would she choose to picture herself like this? Who is this woman? I felt really intrigued. So I dug into the archives and I found this other leaflet that she had produced in 1919 with a photograph of, it's called a starving baby, but it's actually a 2-year-old little girl who hasn't developed. So she looks like a baby, can't support herself on her legs and so on. And Eglantine independently produced this leaflet after the piece and started distributing it in Trafalgar Square. And in the top of the leaflet, in her handwriting, it says suppressed with an exclamation mark. And that exclamation mark shows her personal indignation at the continued policy of the government to maintain the economic blockade to Europe after the peace as a way of pushing through harsh peace terms, the result of which was 800 children were dying in Germany every week in the peace because of this economic policy. And she felt if people knew, they'd be as outraged as she. So the government arrested her and took her away.
What a woman.
I mean she's just magnificent. There's so much more. She's taken away and she insists on conducting her own defence when her case came to trial. And the Crown prosecutor, Sir Archibald Bodkin, didn't spare her in his condemnation, but she was found guilty on technicality. When she's sentenced, it's just £5, which could have been £5 for every leaflet, and she'd shifted 800 of them. She goes to pay her fine, and Sir Archibald, the prosecutor at a trial, pays it for her because he says, you've won the moral case. And she says, well, I can't take your money, but I'll put it to a fund to help the children. It was the first ever fund to save the children was from the Crown prosecutor at her trial.
That's how
she was found guilty.
Wow.
That's how Save the Children was started. And then she went on and launched it very ambitiously at the Royal Albert Hall in front of a crowd who turned up with rotten fruit to throw at this traitor woman that wanted to give succour to what people thought of as the enemy children. She silenced the lot of them with a very dramatic statement, and they spontaneously took up a collection. I actually admire her massively, and I've called my daughter Eglantine.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because you dedicate the book to your daughters, and I saw that Eglantine was the second name of one of them.
Yes,
that
second is after... name. First name, I thought, was a little bit harsh in this day and age.
So obviously she had a profound effect on you, learning about this woman.
I worked for Save the Children for some years, and I was very inspired by the work of it. And then I came across Eglantine's story, and I couldn't believe it. This extraordinary woman wasn't particularly maternally motivated. She achieved so much, not just with Save the Children, but also with the Child Rights Declaration, so important today. And yet she's completely unheard of today. So I thought I'd write a little article. I was on maternity leave with my first daughter, and I thought I'd just sort of jot something off. And 7 years later, I had 3 kids, an MA focusing mainly on Eglantine, and then a book. And then it won the Daily Mail Prize when it came out. I fell off my chair. That was 10 years ago, and the book's just been reissued for the centenary of Save the Children, and all the royalties from the book do go to the charity.
So her legacy is very profound in many ways. I mean, obviously, there's a great legacy with charity still going and more awareness about children's issues, but on you as well, because how many books later are you now? 3, 4 books later?
Yes, I have to be very grateful to her because that was my first book, and I've since become a proper writer, whatever that means. And I met my husband through Save the Children. He was a donor to the charity. And so, I feel quite a strong connection, but really just inspired by this extraordinary woman.
Why is she so little known then?
Eglantine, I think, was kept slightly quiet for a while because she fell in love with a man, which didn't work, and then she fell in love with a woman, which also didn't work, sadly. In fact, the woman was John Maynard Keynes' younger sister, Margaret Keynes, and they had a very passionate relationship. They were deeply in love, but in those days there was no way. So her girlfriend ended up marrying someone. In fact, a professor of frog muscle mechanics. I can only imagine how much that must have hurt Eglantine, although he was a brilliant physiologist and actually won a Nobel Prize later. And so Eglantine turned her back on love, really, and maybe that's better for us, sad for her, but she threw herself into her work. But I think probably more importantly than that, and thank gosh we can move on from that now, is just the fact that she's a woman. And so many women's stories are still untold. There's this rich seam of stories that we're only beginning to look at. And when they have been looked at, they tend to have been looked at in quite romantic terms. You know, I've written about the female special agents, and it's very much, they were so beautiful. Actually, they achieved a lot for the Allied war effort. And I think with Eglantine as well, people have just sort of written her off as domestic, maternal, sentimental. That's not her story.
If she walked into a room now and sat down, would you like her, do you think? What kind of impression would she make?
I think I'd get on with her like a house on fire. She was strident, opinionated, determined. She also wrote romantic novels, not very well. There's all these other sides to her. She's very, very witty, quite an acerbic sense of humour, which kept her going and kept me going doing my research as well. There's a lot to love about her. Obviously, I'd just be slightly concerned what she would think of the book. Certainly, I know that she did everything she could to support the fund. And because all the money from the book is donated to Save the Children, I think she'd be delighted with it. But you just got that inkle at the back of your mind. Would she like? Have I got it right? I'd love to know.
Are there members of her family around? Nieces, nephews, great nieces?
Yes, they are. There are indeed. So she grew up in Shropshire and then moved to Cambridge. She's got great nieces and nephews still living in the same house that she grew up in Shropshire, where I stayed during my research. They're very generous and invited me in. They actually put me up in her old bedroom, which is wonderful. And there are relatives around the Cambridge area as well. Her sister, Dorothy, who co-founded Save the Children with her, but dropped out fairly early on, had a separate career in politics, an amazing woman as well. She went to Newnham College, and Newnham are actually unveiling rooms dedicated to Eglantine and Dorothy this year to mark the centenary, which is fantastic. So there are relatives in this area as well. There are other things going on because of the centenary. So we've got the rooms in Cambridge, and there's a new bronze bust of Eglantine, which is being unveiled at the Royal Albert Hall on the 20th of May, 100 years and one day after Save the Children was founded at the Royal Albert Hall. So some great stuff happening.
It makes you think that if she were around today, she'd be on the list of Forbes' most influential women, etc. She'd be on the front of magazines.
Absolutely. And why is she not on the new £50 note? Last year, we had a new £20 note and a £2 coin, I think it was. They wanted to put a woman on. Fantastic. And they picked Jane Austen, who I greatly admire as a writer, but they put her on both. Can the Treasury not think of another woman to go on the other one? And we've got these incredible women. Let's start remembering them properly.
Because presumably, undoubtedly, Eglantine saved lives.
Millions. Yes. In her lifetime, tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands, millions since, and improved the life chances of many millions more. It is hard to imagine someone who has had a greater impact, not just on this country, but on the world. There's only one country that hasn't signed up to the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which doesn't mean that everyone gets it right, obviously. But now they have some really big tools that can really drive forward change for the better.
And The Woman Who Saved the Children by Claire Mulley is published by One World. And as she said, all royalties from the sale of the book will be donated to Save the Children. Listening to that with me on Bookmark today is Jeremy Johnfield, here to talk about his book, The Boy Who Followed His Father into Auschwitz. Jeremy, Claire saying there what a profound effect Eglantine had had on her life. She named her daughter after it, gave her the middle name. I'm just wondering what writing this book had on your life, what effect it had. Did you start to feel differently about humanity? I mean, you're documenting some of the worst things human beings can do to each other.
Yes, I've always been conscious of the way certain people get othered and dehumanized, and it's made researching the book has made me become more acutely conscious of that. We're in a time when the far right is rising again. It's gaining a foothold. And in researching I decided consciously to tell the story of the whole Kleinman family, not just Gustav and Fritz, because their story as a family was a panorama of the Holocaust. Those who went to the camps and survived, those who went to the camps and didn't survive, and those who managed to escape. And Kurt and his elder sister Edith both got out of Nazi Vienna. Edith came to England Kurt went to America. And their stories are not only remarkable in themselves, but in researching them, I came across repeatedly unsettling, haunting echoes of things that we hear today. The things that were said about Jewish refugees in the 1930s in America and in Britain are almost word for word the kind of things that are said about refugees and immigrants now. It was said that they didn't integrate. They were a threat to the British way of life. They couldn't be relied on to work. They were a drain on the state. They took away British or American workers' jobs. You could transplant the editorials of right-wing newspapers from the 1930s today and change it to usually Muslim immigrants or refugees, and it would be exactly the same. And we're in now what feels like the ground floor of the rise of something like that again, with the rise of the right in America, across Europe, Fortress Europe, which is being closing its doors to refugees, letting them drown in the Mediterranean, and the political right rising. Having really immersed myself in that history of the 30s and 40s, I've become much more acutely aware of that than I ever was before.
Well, let's take a break. Let's go to some music now. And this is Empty Space by Air Traffic, your second choice. Why did you choose this one?
Well, one of the things that really fascinates me about this story is the relationship between Gustav and Fritz, this intensely close father-son relationship. And I think partly that affects me because I didn't have that. There's something that Gustav illustrates how they kept each other going. When they were just about to be sent off to Auschwitz, Gustav wrote in his diary, everyone is saying it's a journey to death, but Fritz and I do not let our heads hang down. I tell myself that a man can only die once. They felt that as long as they had each other, they could face anything. They were so close. I didn't have that. My relationship with my father was quite troubled. And he died without leaving a lot of things unresolved, which I think has left me fascinated by father-son relationships, and this one in particular. And this song is just something that happened to cross my path at the time when my father was dying. And even now, partly because of that, partly because it's an intensely emotional song in itself, it's not about fathers and sons, but it's about a person dying. And it moved me at the time, and it still moves me now.
Space I can't replace with anything at all. The lights are open down and smoke will drive the swimmers down. There's no one left at all.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
I Let's hear from Harriet Kelsall now on Bookmark. Walking down Green Street in central Cambridge, your eye may have been caught by Harriet's jewellery shop. The business has been in existence since 1998 and has won more than 20 UK and international awards for design, business ethics and innovation. Last year, Harriet's book, The Creative's Guide to Starting a Business, How to Turn Your Talent into a Career, was published. And earlier this year, it won the award for Best Startup Inspiration Book at the Business Book Awards. When I met Harriet, I asked her what made her write the book.
Over the years, I've learned loads about business from starting one, and also actually maybe even more about business from talking to other people who are either starting businesses or have started businesses. And I've mentored quite a lot of creative businesses over the years, and I noticed after doing this many times, I noticed there were loads of common threads that I could recognize. Even if a business was, one was a ceramicist and one was a handbag maker, they still had the same problems to overcome, and they still sometimes found the same advice that I was giving useful. I kept seeing all of these common threads, and with my own story as well, I just really started to feel I have to bring these threads together and write this down, because hopefully this can actually help more people and make sure that we can start more successful creative businesses. And if I can do something to help that, that would be amazing.
And what are those common threads?
There are lots of common threads, and actually the book tries to answer all of them. One of them that comes straight to mind is that a lot of creative people put all of their creativity into the items they're making, beautiful pots or clothes or whatever it is they're doing. They get to a point, just like I did, where you think, well, this is what I want to do all the time. I obviously need to start a business in order to facilitate that. And they're not business people with MBAs. They don't, you know, sit there and think about a marketing niche, and, you know, they don't really kind of operate like that. They just make beautiful things and want to make their living that way. They tend to go into business in a way, just like I did, where they grapple around to try and find the information that they need. Oh, I need to employ someone. What do I do? Hit Google, ask people, solve that problem. But they can miss great big chunks of what they really should be doing. And also they can be so busy with what they feel is almost firefighting this stuff that they get very confused about their creative offering. An example of this would be that I find lots of creative people who think that they've found a niche because they're selling their products to friends and family, and the reason they can sell them is actually because they're pricing them so low. They're doing something like doubling their costs and selling a beautiful handmade something or other for sort of 30 quid, whereas actually if they're running that business and they're not, they give up their full-time job and they have to get all of their livelihood out of those beautiful things that they're making, they're going to probably have to treble their prices or double their prices. Then their friends and family might think, oh, £60, that's a bit too much to spend. And so they think they've got a gap, whereas actually their pricing was unsustainable, which means that they haven't really. And so that can be very disheartening because they haven't really investigated the market. So what I find people really need to do is obviously use their creativity in the way they look at the market. So instead of just thinking about their creativity with their products, they need to think, right, who am I actually designing this for? Who wants it? And then actually they need to start a very different way round, and they'll still come back to something they absolutely love doing and that really uses their creativity, but they need to use their creativity in their business thinking. That's what I've tried to put into the book. Another example would be most of the creatives that I've worked with think that if they make a very beautiful piece, they'll be able to put it on Etsy or not the high street or one of the great platforms that exists, and it will just sell. And they don't realize that they're putting their beautiful object into a hugely crowded marketplace where it won't get noticed because they're not actually tackling their approach to market in a creative way. So again, they need to use their creativity with their approach to market as well as with the products themselves.
Well, that answers my question as to why a specific book for creatives, but obviously you're tackling things that are just very specific to people working in the creative industry.
Very much so. People call me an entrepreneur, which I think is quite funny because I don't think I know how to spell it. And maybe it's being dyslexic, but you know, I certainly didn't know how to spell it when I started. And I never set out to start a business. And just like many other creatives, you just want to be creative and make beautiful things and make the world love them. And you know, and that's the way you are. And so you just don't have the same mindset as somebody that thinks, right, I'm going to start a business. What shall I do? You know, you just think about it all in a very different way. And so yes, this book is very much for people who are creative and who usually are making creative products. Having said that, I found that people who were doing other creative industries, things, writers and things have also found it useful, even though it feels more abstract. And also quite a lot of businesses I didn't expect to find it useful have been finding it useful. So, for example, the lovely lady who kindly wrote the forward for the book for me, Shima Barakat, who works with Cambridge University. I think she's head of entrepreneurship. She said this book is useful to everyone. And I think she's been recommending it to some STEM businesses because actually it's about a creative thought process. And even if it's not a creative thing you're selling, a lot of that still sort of applies. So that's been a surprise. But yes, that's why it was specifically for creative people.
So how did you decide to structure it?
I thought about it long and hard, and actually I wrote the book about three times. I decided that what was really needed was lots of case studies, because I think that when you're trying to sort of understand quite a complicated concept, if you can read lots of different versions of how that concept has worked for different people, then it really helps you understand it. One idea, like how do you bring your product to market, can be answered in so many different ways. And in order to understand how to think creatively about it, if you see three completely different versions of that, you start to think, oh, or I could do this, or I could do this, and it sort of sets your creativity off. So I structured it in a way where there were lots of case studies. So I tried to illustrate everything that I found with at least one case study, often more. And I structured it in a way where I sort of think through the different parts of your journey when you're thinking about starting a business. I think, you know, one of the first things you need to do actually is, before you even think about what you're doing business-wise, is decide, what's my definition of success? Because actually, some people feel really successful if they can just manage to do a bit of the creative thing they love and work around their family, whereas other people are not going to feel successful until their household name with 10 shops. And so actually, not until you really understand where you're going, what your success is going to look like to you, can you start to figure out what the best way of getting there is. So that's fairly near the beginning. And then I thought about something which, when I started a business, I didn't know what it was, which is a business plan. What I soon discovered is that a business plan can be really simple. It can be really short, and really all you're doing is writing out what you want to do and how you're going to do it. When I thought about it like that, I tried to structure the book in a way where it takes you through writing a business plan, but you don't really know that's what you're doing. You're just looking at, oh, right, what do I want to make? And, oh, how much will it cost? Pricing, I need to really understand that. And who am I going to sell it to? And how am I going to work that out? And sort of all of these aspects. But actually, when you get to the end, you have written a business plan without really realizing that that's what you were doing. So it is structured in a way loosely around the concept of a business plan without saying that out loud.
And how much of yourself did you put in it? Because you mentioned there things that you wish you'd known.
I put lots of my own story in there because it's very easy for people to look at businesses that they perceive to be successful and think, oh, you know, that must be so great, I just wish I could do that, and not realise that the journey is really tough and that there have been masses of difficult things that every successful business person has been through. And so I did try to share that because I think it's important to share the lows as well as the highs, because that's what we're all trying to get through. That's life, isn't it? And business is just part of life, especially if you're working in a business that is your creative passion. It's very much a part of you. I thought it was important to share some of those downs as well as the ups, and to show people that in many ways what separates a successful creative business owner from a less successful one is often that they just don't give up. When they come across all sorts of problems and all sorts of barriers, they just think, oh, okay, I'll solve a different problem, or I'll solve that problem differently, or I will go around it a slightly different way, I'll use my creativity to figure this out. It's not that they don't have any problems. It's just that they decide that that's okay, and they realise that solving those problems is part of running a successful creative business, not an obstacle that means you should back away and stop and do something else.
And has it whetted your appetite? Do you want to write more books now?
I kind of don't and I kind of do. I really knew nothing when I started writing the book about writing books. And in fact, I approached it completely wrongly. I just wrote the book. I didn't talk to anybody about it. I didn't find a publisher. I just wrote it. Then I approached a publisher who said, oh, this is great, but can you do this, this and this? And you know, it was an interesting journey. But now I feel I do know more about the structure and process. I would love to write another one. And the thing that's been on my mind is that when I was interviewing all of the case studies for the book, I found that so many of these successful creative people are dyslexic. It's very clear to me that there's a synergy between successful creative business runners, owners, and dyslexia. And I think it's a great advantage in creative business. And so I'd really like to look at that in a bit more detail and really try to unravel that. I see my dyslexia as a huge advantage because people who aren't dyslexic are really good at doing one thing at a time, which I'm not very good at doing. But people with dyslexia are really good at doing 20 things at a time. And that's what you need to be able to do when you're running a business. So you've got these great advantages. You're usually a natural problem solver, and you're usually a three-dimensional thinker, and you're usually a good delegator because you know already what you can't do. All of these things, I think, can help a creative business be more successful. And I'd really like to try to write something that puts that out there and says, do you know what, we need to reframe this. Dyslexia isn't some disability and some disadvantage where you just have to try and be as good as anyone else. It's actually a huge advantage. If you have a chip on your shoulder about it, that's the thing that's going to hold you back, not the dyslexia itself.
The Creative's Guide to Starting a Business by Harriet Kelsall is published by Newman. We've been talking on Bookmark today to Jeremy Dronfield about his book, The Boy Who Followed His Father into Auschwitz, which is published by Michael Joseph. We're coming to the end of our time with you, sadly, Jeremy. What's next for you now after this? How do you follow this? I mean, it's very harrowing. It's completely absorbed you.
I haven't actually decided what to do next. For the first time in a long time, I don't actually have a book lined up. For most of the past 6 years, I've been going from one book to another. I've taken on a lot of books, and they've been extremely intense to write and to research. And I made myself quite seriously ill at one point. And I was just going from one book to another. As soon as I'd finished one and sent it to the final draft to the publisher, I'd be having to throw myself into the next one. But for the first time in 6 years, I find myself without a book to go straight to. I've got a bit of leisure time to sit back and reflect and think about what kind of book I want to do next. And of course, this book has had such a reception. It's been read by a lot of people. And as a result, people have sent me their stories, their family's Holocaust stories. And they're all true, they're all real, they're all powerful, they're all very emotional. And
that's quite a decision for you to decide
I can't write them all.
Yeah.
And I have to face the decision whether I want to write any of them. There is one that I'm fairly seriously considering. I won't say anything about it because it may not end up happening. There is one that really stands out, another story about family bonds holding people together in the camps, and also a love story. But as I said, I won't
say any more about it. Congratulations on this book. It is extraordinary. And just briefly, the question we ask all our guests on Bookmark, what are you reading at the moment?
Well, staying with the same subject at the moment, I've been given a preview copy of a book that's coming out next month from Penguin called The Volunteer by Jack Fairweather, which is another true story of a man who voluntarily went to Auschwitz. In this case, it's a relatively well-known story. It's the story of the Polish army officer, Witold Pilecki, who volunteered to go into Auschwitz as a prisoner in order to join the resistance, the Polish army prisoner resistance in the main camp. And his main role was to gather intelligence, things like that, on behalf of the resistance. And that's what I'm reading.
Oh, I think you deserve a holiday at some point, Jeremy. We'll come back to you in just a moment for your last choice of music. But a heads up that our next show studio guest is Michael Bravo, talking about his book, North Pole, Nature and Culture. We'll also hear from Juliet Blaxland on her book, The Easternmost House, which is about living literally on the edge of a cliff in Suffolk. And Harry Sidebottom will be chatting about his new novel, The Lost Ten, described as Jack Reacher in ancient Rome. We'll come now to your last choice of music, Jeremy. Not an easy listen, this, is it?
No.
Penderecki, Threnody to the Victims of Hiroshima. Tell me about this.
Well, I came across this, I was going to say this drifted into my field of view. It more came crashing into my field of view while I was writing the book. Penderecki is a modernist Polish composer, and his compositions tend to be quite dissonant. He's actually he's quite good at evoking horror, and hence the piece about Hiroshima is quite a few Penderecki compositions were used by Stanley Kubrick as in the soundtrack of The Shining, and that gives you a feeling for the flavour, the atmosphere of his compositions. And I came across this one that was used by David Lynch in the revival series of Twin Peaks. And although it was written about Hiroshima, I felt it evoked the atmosphere of Auschwitz, and I listened to it while thinking about Auschwitz, and it helped convey that feeling of horror and sadness.